From Hawaii to Massachusetts, Oregon to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Medicare for All and other such plans to nationalize health insurance would force the closure of many rural hospitals. Lauren Crawford Schaefer of the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future is here to explain. Republicans scored big wins in two special congressional elections in North Carolina this past week. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Trump administration is clamping down on e-cigarettes, but have they overreached? Eric Boehm talks with Jacob Solem of Reason Magazine. And must everything be political these days? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Many of the nation's rural hospitals are barely staying afloat financially, and proposals such as Medicare for All would result in many of them being forced to close. Lauren Crawford Schaefer is Executive Director of the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future. She is here to talk about the issue. Lauren, welcome to American Radio Journal. Lauren, let's talk, first of all, a little bit about your organization, the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future. What is your organization all about, and what are your goals?
The Partnership for America's Healthcare Future is an organization that is focused heavily on building and improving upon what's currently working in our healthcare system and fix what is not. So looking across all of our broader healthcare, we think about lowering costs, expanding patient choice, improving access, enhancing quality, and fostering innovation to better our current system. To be honest with you, if it's Medicare for All, Medicare buy-in, or the public option, we do not see a one-size-fits-all healthcare helping us achieve those goals. So we support building on the strength of the employer-provided healthcare system, preserving Medicare to our nation's seniors, expanding Medicaid in places where it has not been expanded, and other solutions where we currently see hundreds of Americans leveraging and using the healthcare that they have today.
As we look at that, Lauren, studies have shown, polls have shown, that most of the American public is right where you are on this issue, are they not? Because what they'd like to see us do is to fix what's broken as opposed to throwing the whole thing out and having a whole new system.
Yeah, we actually see polls from everywhere from the Kaiser Family Foundation to Morning Consult to the Quinnipiac poll, and many of them in between point to Americans wanting to build upon our current system. They might not think it's perfect, but they also think it's pretty dang good, and there's ways to improve it rather than starting over with a brand new system. And that's one of the questions I ask most people who pitch or present ideas to me about any type of healthcare plan is, what is it a new healthcare plan or a new healthcare idea is actually trying to solve for? And if you're looking to solve for access, you know, 90% of Americans currently have coverage. And I'd rather spend our time getting those last 10% covered than starting over at zero and thinking about a new system to get to 100% coverage. And if you're looking to address costs, I'd like to look at the improvements and the cost containments that have been put into place in the last 10 years, rather than starting with a brand new plan that would not even address those costs and actually strip out some of those improvements that have been passed with the Affordable Care Act.
We, of course, are in a presidential election cycle, which means all sorts of ideas are being bounced around out there. And Lauren, one of the biggest talking points on the campaign trail for Democratic candidates especially has been this idea of a public option or Medicare for All. And in addition to the cost, there is an impact, particularly on rural hospitals. And we want to get to the heart of a study that was done by Navigant, where they took a look at rural hospitals all across America, and I would also like you to speak to how many of those there are and how important they are, but what would the impact of all these public options be on this massive number of rural hospitals we have?
Yeah, you're referring to a study that was conducted between the partnership and with Navigant Consulting that looked at a public option. I think a lot of candidates and a lot of people may view and hear as a public option as just that, another option, another opportunity for a healthcare plan. But really, when you step back and think about what a public option is, there are some really big fundamental questions on how a public option would become the law of the land and actually implemented. For example, a public option Are you reimbursing at current Medicare rates? Are you going to have a plan that is modeled off of the exchanges? And are you trying to make it so the people who currently don't have Medicaid have coverage, or are you looking for a different population? So there's a lot of questions about that. But what we did is we wanted to say, okay, if a public option was implemented, what would happen to rural communities? You know, 60 million Americans currently live in rural communities. It's a big number of people, and they already have hospitals that have very, very razor-thin margins and are struggling to stay open to make sure that they have health care in the communities that they want. We looked at it, and we realized that 55% of rural hospitals would be at high risk of financial closure across the country. That's over 1,000 hospitals touching 46 states. So it's going to have a huge negative impact if you have a public option and with a shift in people moving to it, those hospitals not be able to sustain themselves. And unfortunately, that healthcare in those communities would really be impacted, and people would have to travel further to get the care that they need and want. And that, again, goes back to that core question I always ask, what are you trying to solve for in any type of healthcare proposal and to the partnership? The removal of hospitals in those rural communities doesn't seem like a step forward.
In terms of those rural hospitals, already we've had the Affordable Care Act has been in place now for a number of years. How have these rural hospitals been faring under the current system where we have the exchanges and you sort of have a mix of being able to buy insurance on exchanges, being able to have private or employer-provided health care? Has this already had an impact on rural hospitals?
I think rural hospitals have really had to shift some of their business model in the last 10 years. Some have closed, and you do see some rural hospitals with some financial challenges, but others have adjusted their business model. And that's actually one of the things you're hearing from either candidates and members of Congress that are not necessarily tied to Medicare for All proposals, but are making sure rural Medicare reimbursement rates are higher than other reimbursement rates, so that hospital has a bit more ability to sustain itself. But in our study, what we looked at is if these hospitals are already at risk and we had a shift of people that would change over to a public option plan, what would happen to those hospitals? What would happen to the revenues there, and what would happen to those communities by losing those hospitals? And that's what we looked at. And that's where we were seeing 55%, over half of the rural hospitals in this community would be impacted.
You mentioned something really interesting, and that is what happens to a community? If a community hospital in a rural area closes, does that, Lauren, have an impact even beyond healthcare?
Absolutely. It has a huge economic impact. Hospitals are huge employers, both within their facility, between the physicians, the nurses, the custodial staff, the support staff, the companies and businesses that are actually in those hospitals themselves, and also the healthcare network that they are a part of. So not only are you looking at a hospital being closed and beds not being able to be used and leveraged for the patients that need them the most, but you're also looking at a major employer leaving some of these communities. That also means that tax base that supports that community would also have a negative impact. So this is not just delivering healthcare to patients, which is a massive thing on its own. There is a large economic impact to this too, that really hasn't been felt yet, and I hope isn't felt through this type of proposal.
It's interesting. I was looking at some of the maps that accompany the Navigant study, and my first thought was, could this be a red state, blue state issue, where the more rural red states would be impacted more? But, Lauren, it was interesting. If you look at states like California and New York, particularly Illinois, there are a lot of rural areas in those states also. So is this something that affects all of America and not just certain political parts of America?
Absolutely. In fact, this really, really impacts all of America. If you look at some of the most highly impacted states, you mentioned a few of them, but it's also Michigan and Wisconsin and Iowa and Illinois and Indiana and Ohio. Like, it's actually very much in the heartland a bit as well. But it actually touches every single state with the exception of one. So that's actually, I think, the most kind of shocking, is that we aren't calling out purple states or blue states or red states. We're calling out all states that would have an impact.
We have been talking with Lauren Crawford Shaver, who is Executive Director of the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future. Lauren, could you give us a place on the web where folks can go to learn more about your organization and this issue? Also, where can they access the Navigant study that we've been discussing?
Folks should go to americashealthcarefuture.org. They can learn about our organization. They can sign up to learn more on a regular basis. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook as well. In addition, on that site, that's where the Navigant study is. Again, it's americashealthcarefuture.org. You can download it. You can read our highlights, read our press releases, and hopefully it's a resource for you.
Lauren Crawford Shaver of the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future. Lauren, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Scott Parkinson, as usual, is at the Club for Growth. It has been a very big week politically. We're going to talk about it. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
And especially a big week for all of our friends in the great state of North Carolina. We had two special congressional elections, highly unusual, different reasons for both. Let's start out by talking about North Carolina 3. Scott, why was there an open seat? And it did play out as anticipated, correct?
That's right. This is a heavily Republican district, and if your listeners recall, Congressman Walter Jones passed away at the beginning of the year, creating the vacancy. There was a highly contested Republican primary with over a dozen candidates, and through that there was two candidates that emerged for the Republican runoff, Joan Perry and Greg Murphy. Greg Murphy is a very solid conservative. He's going to do a good job, and I know that he's going to be mentored by Congressman Mark Meadows, one of his colleagues from the North Carolina congressional delegation. And we're excited about how he can be a real effective legislator here in Washington, and especially we'll be watching him closely on how he promotes an agenda related to economic opportunity and economic growth.
So that election was not hotly contested in terms of the final general special election. The opposite was true in North Carolina 9, and just the circumstances that created that opening were highly unusual. Can you give us some background as to how that
Sure.
opening occurred?
Last November, the Republicans in North Carolina carried Mark Harris to victory in a really, really tight race. And the North Carolina Board of Elections found evidence of voter fraud and refused to certify the election. So what that created was a situation where we needed a new special election. Harris decided not to run. And again, this was another wide open race with several candidates. Club for Growth was the first to make a significant endorsement behind State Representative Dan Bishop. Mr. Bishop has really been a principled pro-growth conservative in the state Senate, a very, very strong, solid conservative voting record, and we were excited to get behind his candidacy. In contrast to what happened in the North Carolina 3 race, this one was really a coin flip in many ways. So all of the efforts that Club for Growth Action and Club for Growth PACs put behind his candidacy really mattered. Our members contributed over $193,000 directly to Bishop's winning campaign through our Club for Growth PAC. That's how we bundle donations. And the Club for Growth Super PAC, Club for Growth Action, spent over $996,000 for a total of $1,189,000. This is the third most expensive race that Club for Growth has ever participated in. And the reason is obviously the Charlotte market is an expensive market, but Dan McCready had very high name recognition, having been on the ballot against Harris last fall. He'd basically been campaigning for 2.5 years for this position. So we knew that it was going to be an uphill battle. Going in to Election Day, our data showed that early voting was heavily favoring Dan McCready, and Bishop was down, I would say, close to 10,000 votes. And that's fairly significant. That meant on Election Day that Dan Bishop would need to get 57% of the vote in what is essentially a swing district. You'll recall, your listeners will recall, that President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence went down to the district. Pence campaigned with Bishop the day before on Monday, and Monday evening, President Trump held a rally. And I think that it's incredibly indicative of the power that President Trump has to motivate and build enthusiasm among his base, Republican voters, the forgotten voter, people that typically might sit out an election, And I think he made a very strong case for why we needed Dan Bishop over Dan McCready, helping him and supporting his agenda in Congress. So the bottom line is, President Trump is the closer. He can certainly make a big difference when he wants to get involved in really tight races. So far, conservatives are 3-for-3 in the special elections this year, and we'll be having a special election in the 7th Congressional District of Wisconsin next year following Congressman Sean Duffy's resignation. We'll also be having certainly a number of open races due to all the House Republican retirements. There's going to be a ton of races down in Texas. We've got competitive races in South Carolina and Oklahoma, Virginia, Maine, races where we have a chance to pick off the Democrat. And so what we're going to be doing is encouraging the president to get behind candidates early, make a clear distinction on who can support his agenda and who cannot, and really try to reverse any remaining remnants of a blue wave that we saw in 2018 and make sure that the tide changes toward Republican wave where we have a shot to get back the House of Representatives.
When we look back at 2018, of course, the Democrats saw that as sort of a bellwether for 2020. But Scott, we all know that when you've seen one election, you've seen one election, and 2020 is going to be very different. The Democrats, Scott, made a big deal over the fact that they thought they were going to win this swing district in North Carolina, pointing to what they perceived as Republican weakness, particularly in suburban areas. The fact that President Trump was able to go in there and turn the tide and bring the victory across the finish line, Scott, is this a trend that he's going to be able in 2020 to really have a strong impact on U.S. Senate and U.S. House races going forward?
Oh, yeah. The top of the ticket is so important here. I think that voters are excited and enthusiastic about coming out for President Trump, but we know that if Joe Biden is the nominee, this is going to be a dogfight. And presidential races over the last couple of decades have been very, very close in America. And you can tick off all the swing states that President Trump flipped, from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin to Michigan. You know, he obviously won Florida, Iowa, Ohio, North Carolina, states that President Obama was very competitive in, or at least won. And there's other states that could be added to the map.
Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. Your listeners can check us out on our website at clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can actually become a member of the Club for Growth for free. I'd also encourage everybody to check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Thanks.
Growing health concerns over the use of e-cigarettes have caused the Trump administration to take action, but have they gone too far too fast? Eric Boehm explores the issue with Reason Magazine senior editor Jacob Sullum. Eric?
President Donald Trump on Wednesday afternoon announced plans to ban all non-tobacco flavored e-cigarettes or vaping devices. He made that announcement in a press conference at the White House on Wednesday, and it's a decision that Reason Magazine's Jacob Sullum says will harm public health in the name of protecting it. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and you're listening to American Radio Journal. My guest today is the aforementioned Jacob Sullum. He's a senior editor for Reason, and he joins us on the phone now to discuss the e-cigarette ban that was announced this week by the president. Jacob, thanks for taking some time and being here with us.
No problem.
Now, Jacob, you've been following the e-cigarette, the vaping regulatory regime and policy for years now. This is probably the most sweeping thing or the most stunning decision that's been made in that realm, at the federal level, at least. Tell us a little bit about exactly how this is going to be executed. The FDA is just going to strip all of these vaping products right out of the market?
Because of the way the FDA is regulating e-cigarettes, basically all the products that are currently on the market are there only because the FDA is letting them be there. In the near future, every company is supposed to apply for regulatory approval of their products. So the FDA does not have to issue any new rules. It can just say, you know what, we allowed you this leeway. We're not allowing it anymore. We're going to make an enforcement priority out of the flavored e-cigarettes. Their intent is to remove all flavored e-cigarettes from the market with the exception of tobacco flavor. And I guess I should note that actually is a flavor. It's not like e-cigarettes naturally taste like tobacco. They don't actually contain tobacco. They contain nicotine. They can add tobacco flavoring, which is pretty disgusting if you've, ever tried it. And you can imagine just on the face of it why somebody trying to quit smoking wouldn't want his e-cigarette to taste like tobacco. It might be a trigger for him to return to his former habit. He might want something that resembles smoking in certain ways. You're inhaling something that delivers nicotine quickly, but he might actually prefer to have a different flavor. And in fact, if you look at the market, you will see that overwhelmingly people who have switched from smoking to vaping prefer flavors other than tobacco. Tobacco accounts for maybe, depends on the survey you look at, but maybe something like 8% of the flavors that vapers prefer. And overwhelmingly, they are using all these other flavors that are supposedly kid-friendly. So it's not as if, you know, teenagers do like these flavors, no question. But adults like them, too, very clearly. So you can't say, oh, if they offer an e-cigarette that tastes like mango, obviously they're appealing to children because, in fact, that is by far the most popular flavor, for example, of Juul. Juul pods among adult vapers.
So, yeah, I mean, you touched on it there, Jacob. This is all being done out of a concern about teens vaping. There's been this this marked increase in teenagers who are using e-cigarettes. And whether that's cause for concern or not, I guess, depends on how you view the relative health of vaping devices. But regardless, it's already illegal for teenagers to buy these devices. Any teenager who's using them is using them illegally. But now the president and the FDA are going to make it illegal for adults to buy these products, too. And I'm not sure how that combats teen vaping. Like, there seems to be a disconnect there. Am I just missing something?
Well, what they're saying is that we can't enforce the age restrictions. They're implicitly saying we can't enforce it. It's not true. Now, for example, Juul actually has moved forward already with an age verification system on their website where you actually have to supply data that verifies who you are and that you are, actually their standard is 21 or older. Legally, the minimum standard is 18 or older. Evidently, teenagers are getting the many, you know, getting e-cigarettes anyway. There are a lot of retailers, judging from the FDA's enforcement efforts, who are not paying attention to the age restriction. So a more logical response would be say, let's enforce these restrictions better. Let's come up with age verification systems. If the problem is in fact, that you're trying to address is in fact underage vaping, there are a number of measures they could have taken without actually prohibiting adults from buying these products. So it's a huge leap to go from, by the same logic, you could say kids drink, therefore we're going to ban all alcoholic beverages.
Well, how big of a problem is this to begin with? Should we be worried about teens vaping?
Vaping increased sharply last year. And again, they just released data showing that it increased again this year among teenagers. If they're getting the flavored e-cigarettes and we're saying we can't really enforce the age restrictions, then they're going to get the tobacco flavored ones to the extent that they want them. But then also you have a whole black market where you have third party manufacturers who are not subject to FDA regulation producing, for example, Juul compatible pods or producing e-liquids in a whole wide range of flavors. And those things are not regulated anyway. These manufacturers are not inspected by the FDA. They're never visited by them. And you have no idea what's in that. And then this recent concern about an outbreak of respiratory disease among vapers, which primarily has to do with black market THC products. But to the extent that these are actually related to nicotine vaping, in all likelihood, it's because of black market products. So this policy will drive teenagers as well as adults toward black market or gray market substitutes for the banned flavors, and that's going to expose them to more risk.
And of course, the people who have the most to lose here are smokers that are using e-cigarettes to quit because they taste better, perhaps. That's something, you know, that there's reduced harm there by switching from traditional cigarettes to e-cigarettes. That may be harder to do now. This policy, it seems to me like it's basically, it's heavy-handed, it's short-sighted. I'm not really sure what the Trump administration thinks they are accomplishing here. Unfortunately, though, we are out of time for today. We could talk about this a whole lot longer. Jacob, again, thanks so much for joining us. Lots of great stuff here. Wish we had more time to go through it. We'll have to have you on again soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
And again, that is Jacob Sullum. He is a senior editor for Reason Magazine. You can find his work and mine at Reason.com. I am Eric Boehm. Thanks for joining us, folks, and you can catch me again next week right back here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Even leisure time pursuits have become entangled in politics, as Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A friend emailed me last October. "I went to a quilt guild meeting today," she said, "and discovered that even quilting has been politicized. It's purely political," she continued. "The State Quilt Guild was touting a traveling quilt show called Threads of Resistance. I'll let you guess what that was about. You'll be right. Clearly time for me to re-examine being a member of the guild. This is just awful. I can't stand it." Yes, Threads of Resistance. Grandma hooks up with Antifa. Can you imagine how ridiculous? My friend was upset. I'll leave her nameless to protect her. She emailed me again in February. She wrote, "You laughed when I brought up how even quilting has become politicized, e.g. Threads of Resistance and similar projects. Since I also knit, the following was of interest also, in a the world has truly gone bat guano crazy kind of way. This looks to be even more dangerous, actually ruining people's online businesses." My friend there included a link to a website called Quillit.com, which featured an article titled "A Witch Hunt on Instagram" regarding the politicization of knitting. "Knitting is just so white," one voice in the article amended. "Seriously? We're going to condemn knitting as racist? What's next? Lectures on queer theory and cultural Marxism at Wednesday Night Graphs?" The article documented how websites like Ravelry.com, which is apparently the top source for knitting chat forums and finding online knitting patterns by independent designers, had become ideological. "This might seem trivial," my friend noted to me, particularly in light of major national issues that she'd listed off in her email, but she's frustrated nonetheless. She asked me to report on these shenanigans. I didn't report at the time because I was disgusted. It was too painful to think about. But since then, the story has oozed into the public consciousness, and some of my colleagues have begun writing about it, as it has only gotten worse. The latest exhibit is this Twitter statement from Ravelry.com. Quote, "We are banning support of Donald Trump and his administration on Ravelry. We cannot provide a space that is inclusive of all and also allow support for open white supremacy. More details, Ravelry.com, content, blah, 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 blah." That's the full tweet. My friend's reaction? "Again, you may find this trite," she emailed, "but it's indicative of the depth of the divide in the country." Yes, it sure is. My friend has personally left the Ravelry email list and admits to being not surprised by any of this. "It's enough," she said, "to make you not want to be part of a crafts group." She's happy to see some people pushing back. She said it's really difficult for people with little businesses like her to get anywhere in this poisoned political environment, especially, she says, when you've made the decision, as she has, not to do special orders. That's where the money is, she says, but it's also where the lawsuits lurk. For the record, my friend is not a Donald Trump supporter. She finds the man distasteful. She is also, however, the kind of person who finds politicization distasteful. She owns a crafts business. Good grief, can't the woman knit in peace? It's pretty sad when even quilts become acrimonious. And don't blame this, liberals, on Donald Trump. Sure, Trump is a divisive figure. I'm a Republican, I admit that. But there's no reason why knitting must be ideological. Knitters of the world, unite against Trump! It's another sign of how toxic our discourse has become. Please, folks, must even knitting tear us apart? Pun intended. Let's have the integrity to stay, above the fray. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WMTA-FM in Central City and Greenville, Kentucky. Welcome to our new listeners in the Bluegrass State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.